Our next case is number 04-1517, the United States against Richard Goodwin. Ms. Amber.
May it please the court, I am Linda Amder, and I am court-appointed to represent defendant appellant Richard Goodwin. I will briefly explain why defendant Goodwin has not forfeited his sentencing challenge, and then I will turn full attention to the Second Amendment argument. Defendant Goodwin's case, at a minimum, should be remanded for resentencing, at which the district court should have full discretion, unfettered by the guidelines, to impose a sentence that he believes is appropriate within the statutory range set by Congress. Goodwin's argument against severability and his argument that the federal sentencing guidelines are invalid in their entirety following Blakely was unavailable to him at the time of his sentencing, and he did not forfeit that argument. In Blakely versus Washington, the Supreme Court held that the defendant was denied his Sixth Amendment right to jury trial and proof beyond reasonable doubt. Defendant Blakely had pled guilty under the Washington statutes and pled guilty to an offense that corresponded to a specific substandard range. At the sentencing, the judge, on his own, found an aggravating sentencing factor and sentenced Blakely to more than 3 years beyond the sentence to which he had confessed or admitted. The case was remanded for further proceeding. This court found in Booker that the rule of Blakely applies to sentencing under the federal sentencing guidelines. At the present time, the Supreme Court will decide Booker. They will decide whether the guidelines will remain in place, but with jury determinations required for increases or enhancements in sentences. And they will decide whether the guidelines with the Sixth Amendment protection for sentencing enhancements are not severable and whether there must be a return to indeterminate sentencing, at least for now. Possibly they will agree with the Justice Department that in those cases where there is an enhancement deserving Sixth Amendment protection, that the guidelines will simply become advisory, but that in all other cases they will remain in place. Obviously, what my brief addresses will be the situation where if, in fact, the Supreme Court is to find that the guidelines are invalid in their entirety. The overriding issue is whether the guidelines requirement that a judge make certain findings based on the preponderance of the evidence, whether that is severable from the other substantive provisions of the guidelines, and whether the guidelines, after that is removed, are thereafter workable. And, of course, we have submitted a brief making arguments that they are not severable. If they are found not severable, then Goodwin's sentence should be vacated. And today I come before you, since this issue has not yet been decided, to preserve this argument for Mr. Goodwin and to argue to this court that cannot be said to have forfeited this issue, as the government states. Goodwin was sentenced on February the 23rd, 2004. The constitutionality of the federal guidelines was not at issue at that time before the Supreme Court. The Blakely opinion was never issued until June the 28th of 2004, and before Judge Scalia had and at that time, Judge Scalia specifically stated in his Blakely decision that the guidelines were not before the Supreme Court. The only issue that could relate to the guidelines in Blakely was the Sixth Amendment issue of trial by jury and proof beyond a reasonable doubt when there was a question of an enhancement beyond an applicable sentencing range. Not until Booker did the validity of the entire guidelines become an issue with associated arguments of severability. In our particular case, there was no issue of a sentencing enhancement. There was an issue. We argued Apprendi, but the judge never granted that particular enhancement. My client was convicted as an armed career criminal. His particular guideline range was then found in the table that corresponds to a specific guideline, and he was sentenced in that range by the Honorable Judge Connelly. Judge Connelly did not have the discretion at that time to sentence below the range. He was simply applying Seventh Circuit law, and he made that quite clear at his sentencing, that his finding was based upon certain Seventh Circuit law denying downward departure. It's simply our position that if the guidelines are found unconstitutional or invalid in their entirety, Mr. Goodwin's case should be remanded for sentencing in front of Judge Connelly, and he should be given full discretion. Getting on then to the Second Amendment argument that we've presented, defendant submits that the Second Amendment reserves to the states the authority to regulate possession of firearms by citizens, and that only states can disarm its citizens. The history of the Second Amendment, read in conjunction with Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, leads to the conclusion that under Article 1, the national government can federalize state militias for limited purposes and can provide arms to the militia. However, due to the express provisions of the later enacted Second Amendment, which was added after Article 1, the federal government cannot disarm the militia. And then I want to address, what is the militia, and what is the militia that the Second Amendment is referring to? At the time of the enactment of the Second Amendment, many citizens within the states feared a concentration of power in the central government and feared standing armies. The Second Amendment sought to protect local democracy by protecting this public military body. States would have an armed populace from which they could form an armed militia. The militia that is talked about in the Second Amendment and that the Anti-Federalists insisted had to be part of the Constitution was a militia that promised a virtuous control of force. It's not the National Guard. The National Guard is a selection of a few people. The militia was the entirety of the citizenry. It was the people. And that is what the Second Amendment is referring to. It's our position, and we believe that this is also carried through in United States versus Miller, that based upon what is reserved in the Second Amendment is not so simply a personal right to an individual as found in Emerson. And it is not simply a state right, but it is a right that goes to the entire citizenry, and it's only the state that can disarm those citizens. We're not saying that the state cannot disarm them, and we're not saying there shouldn't be prohibited individuals from possessing guns, but that is a prerogative of the state to do, not the federal government. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Amber. We'll hear now from Ms. McNiven.
Good morning, Your Honors. Carolyn McNiven on behalf of the government. May it please the Court. I will address first the Blakely and Booker arguments, since that is where my opponent started. And it is, of course, the government's position that the guidelines remain fully applicable in all cases, and in particular that they remain fully applicable in cases such as defendants where the Blakely procedures were not necessary. In this case, contrary to what prior counsel said, the defendant did receive an increased sentence based on his prior convictions. In fact, he was an armed career criminal, and he received a greater sentence beyond the statutory minimum. He, in fact, received a sentence of 235 months, not the 15 years statutory minimum. In this case, it is important to remember that Blakely does not invalidate a defendant's sentence where the sole enhancement was based on prior convictions and where the only factual determinations related to a discretionary denial of downward departure. I'll address, of course, the first, the sole enhancement based on prior convictions. As I said, there was an enhancement. In this case, it was an enhancement based on prior convictions, none of which were contested. The defendant admitted this sentencing was controlled by the Armed Career Criminal Guideline, and there was no factual dispute. As for the issue of forfeiture, in this case, it's the government's position that the defendant did forfeit a constitutional challenge to that enhancement. Specifically, the defendant made an Apprendi argument with respect to a closely related enhancement under the same guideline. In particular, when an armed career criminal possesses the weapon at issue in the felon in possession conviction with respect to attempt to commit a violent offense, he would receive a level 34. This is what the government was arguing the district court was applicable to the defendant based on the defendant's admission in his confession that he was going to take the gun he was possessing in the Chicago high-rise on his way to commit a murder, to murder somebody who had shot him a few weeks before. The defense objected and objected to that one-level enhancement based on Apprendi. The defense made no objection to the level 33 or the career or the criminal history based on Apprendi or any other constitutional challenge. Therefore, it's our position that it was forfeit. Now, with respect to the defendant's argument that essentially, if not one, not any. In other words, if some defendant's sentences are affected by Blakely and Booker, this case should be affected by Blakely and Booker, we say not. First of all, there's congressional intent, which is set forth in our briefs, was clearly intended to channel judicial decision-making in every case to have uniformity. In this case, where there is no judicial fact-finding other than prior convictions, it would be unnecessary to remove the sentencing guidelines which allow for uniformity. It's a little bit akin to saying, let's throw the baby out with the bathwater. So this is not a case, such as Blakely, where there would be an uneven application within the case itself. There is no such uneven application. The defense also objects to the denial of a downward departure. Blakely and Booker have absolutely nothing to do with respect to a denial of a downward departure, and this denial should stand. Of course, we say that it's a discretionary denial, and it is also unreviewable on that basis as well. Now I turn to the defendant's Second Amendment arguments. As this court is well aware, the precedent of this court and others forecloses this argument. It is well settled that the federal felon in possession statute of 922G does not violate the rights of citizens under the Second Amendment, be they considered individual rights or collective rights. This is not a case involving a militia. This is a case involving a man who, as the district court described, had a fairly breathtaking criminal history, including convictions for attempted murder and armed robbery, numerous convictions for robbery. This court's case in United States versus Price, United States versus Gillespie, Hemmings and Gillespie, and even the United States Supreme Court's case in Lewis, all support the position that the felon in possession statute does not violate the defendant's right under the Second Amendment. The precedent is also clear that the Commerce Clause is not offended by the felon in possession statute. The reading that the defense has requested would essentially turn on end a long line of cases that say that there is no requirement of temporal proximity. Your Honor, with that, I would respectfully request that this court uphold the court's sentence of Mr. Goodwin. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McNiven.
Your Honors, again, we bring to this court the fact that we in no way waived or forfeited any Apprendi arguments pertaining to increases or enhancements at our sentencing. We did object to the one that was raised by the government. Again, we argue to this court that the fact that my client was convicted under 924E, and then that is referenced to a specific armed career criminal guideline within the guidelines, does not mean that we have agreed to an enhancement. So we made no type of forfeited argument there. And again, we were not in a position to argue in the district court at that time that the guidelines were invalid in their entirety because of Blakely. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Emder, I believe you served by appointment of the court, and you have the deep thanks of the court for your fine work on behalf of your client. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel in the case, and the case will be taken under advisement.